Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Deeper Grooves, Season 5, Show 49. Two more episodes before the end of the season with your host Cliff Beach, and I am super excited to go across the pond once again to talk to the UK's own Andy Platts from the group Mama's Gun, who we played on my radio show Deeper Grooves on the SoCal Sound. Super excited to be talking about their new album, Cure the Jones. They're getting some great love from KEXP, Glide Magazine, Soul Tracks, Jazzes, and more. Please help me welcome Andy Platts.
Welcome, Andy Platts, everyone, to the platform, 88.5, the SoCal Sound, 88.5 at home interviews, as well as Deeper Grooves. Welcome, Andy, from Mama's Gun, all the way from the UK, across the pond, keeping funk and soul alive. How are you doing?
Yeah, man, good. All right, alive and kicking. And looking forward to crossing that pond and coming over and seeing you guys. That's for sure.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. I know you're going to be doing some touring soon, so we'll chat a little bit about that. But let's talk about the latest new album that's about to drop, Cure the Jones. And you guys have been dropping albums consistently, you know, like over a decade now in the functional space. But what kind of inspired you to create and produce this new record? I'm told it's an 11-song opus. That's true.
Yeah, well, you know, this huge experience that we've all shared globally, I think had a massive impact on the creation of this record. It's very rare that I got so much time on my own to kind of ruminate on stuff and process what was going on, and for so much of that to marry with the musical ideas that I was having at the time. So, you know, this record born of themes of like stamina, endurance, you know, pining, longing for togetherness, longing for union, you know, all these things that we felt have definitely fed into this record. Yeah, and that coupled with us wanting to take this more focused classic 60s, 70s R&B and soul vibe that we've been really honing since the last album, Golden Days. It's all just the sound of a band reaching deeper, digging deeper, looking for something more, and very much wanting to make contemporary music whilst standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, that have made this tapestry of wonderful soul and R&B music that we know and love, you know.
So speaking of standing on the shoulders of giants, you all have had major credits and worked with a lot of people, but you specifically as a vocalist, I saw that you had at one time worked with Rod Temperton. Rod Temperton, who is amazing, obviously the Michael Jackson stuff, Rock With You, etc. But then also Heat Wave, Always and Forever, soundtracks with Michael McDonald, etc. I mean, he's just a legend in the space. So like, how did that come about? What did you do? How was that experience?
Well, I first signed my my first publishing deal in 2005, 2006. And it was Zomba back then. I don't think they exist anymore. But they signed me as an artist. And they were, we think you've got great potential. We love the kinds of songs you're writing, but we think, you know, you can just push the envelope even further and develop yourself. And so they were really my A&R at the publishing was looking to put me with like the flavor of the month, who was having hits in the charts there and stuff to develop my vibe. And I was like, I'm not interested in it, man. I want to work with people who've been there and done it, who've got the t-shirt and really know what they're talking about, who came from that period of classic songcraft, you know. So I made this bit of a list of like, yeah, I'd work with these guys if they were into it. And that included Rod Temperton. It included, John Oates from Hall & Oates. It was Brian Jackson as well, who created all that amazing Gil Scott-Heron music. And I got to work with all these guys just by not being shy. And just, you know, if you don't ask for candy, you won't get it. So that's really how it came about, as simple as that.
Well, now I know why I don't have candy. I'm going to start asking. Super excited now. You've changed my life already. And so I guess let's start from the beginning. So I see a lot of vintage instruments there. Like, what are your, I guess, musical influences? You talked about Gil Scott-Heron, but like, who are your go-tos or as you were kind of growing up into music, like, who did you listen to? Who did you vibe on? Like, who do you try to emulate?
Well, I think everyone kind of begins at their folks' record collections, don't they? So, you know, I was born very much into kind of 60s, 70s British and some American rock, you know, pop and rock. So we're talking, you know, Beatles, all their contemporaries of the day, and then the same guys over the pond, the people at the Doors and stuff. My mum was very much into kind of like anything from Linda Ronstadt to ABBA to Joni Mitchell, a real melting pot. But it's still very much on the kind of pop rock side of things. It wasn't until older, when I was older, that I kind of really fell into kind of soul music. As you know, it's this wonderful place where all these rivers meet, you know, all the gospel and the blues and the... It's just... it's a genre of expression that is without equal for me. It's just, I don't know. It's a language that I feel I just want to kind of become more and more fluent in and spend more time in. But, you know, classics like Marvin Gaye, of course, he's a big influence of mine, but people a bit more off piece like Shuggy Otis and people like that. Obviously, massive Aretha Franklin fan as well. As well as this kind of British lineage of kind of groove music as well. People like Simond and people like that that kind of impacted on me. Yeah, it's too varied really to distill into a kind of coherent response. I'm sure everyone says that. You're like, hey, what are you into? What's the stuff you love? It's like,
yeah,
how long have you got? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I love all that kind of you know, Kenny Loggins and Michael McDonald and that kind of stuff, you know, that side of the coin. So
does Ian Dury make the list?
Ian Dury, yeah. You know, he's not someone's back catalogue that I know really well. I know enough of it to be a fan of it. But it's, you know, definitely one of those artists I would like to spend more time delving into.
For sure. Yeah, I'm a big fan of his work and just you know, having a funk soul pub band at that time, and they got a lot of respect from people like the Pointer Sisters and people who would travel there, who were like, wow, we're surprised that this is happening over here. But Britain and the UK has always loved soul music and continues to allow diversity and organic groups. So I guess being from the UK, like, what, how does that kind of influence your sound? And then I know obviously there's vinyl and record culture and other stuff, shops and venues and things like that. So like, and amazing TV shows that broadcast music like yours as well. So I guess, like, how does the UK kind of shape your experience for our listeners that are based in the US?
Well, I think being Islanders, there's always an aspect of that that feeds into the music, you know, the island being Islanders and the weather. I think that definitely has this this gives the music, I think that Mama's Gun writes anyway, this kind of thoughtful ruminating edge, perhaps gives it some depth, and the way that obviously if we're kind of fans of this initially American-based music, that it's coming through this filter and the way we live our lives and it's coming back out of that. That's an interesting prism for music to go through. You know, we were from the Northern Soul thing and the Motown thing, the UK bought into heavily and has done ever since, you know, all the soul that's come out of an America and more. But I think, yeah, there's something in the songcraft of the great British songwriters and groups that we appreciate. There's an economy and a succinctness to that, that I think I've certainly have tried to fuse with the kind of uplifting joy and pain of soul music. And hopefully somewhere across that spectrum, you get something that's a bit more British in its DNA. But that's not for me to say, you know. You get into a place of self-analysis then, which is just a dog chasing its tail. So I'll leave it there.
yeah, well, I definitely have seen your kind of trajectory, I was glad to be able to get to talk to you. I knew of the group and I played you on my radio show, Deeper Grooves on 88.5, because I think there's a track, This Is The Day. I found you guys through Ubiquity, so the full band version I played of that during a Ubiquity set. And it was cool because I hadn't heard of you before that, but then I started listening to some of the other songs in the catalog. And I liked what I was hearing. I mean, obviously I love funk, soul, organic types of music, but it sounds very authentic, which a lot of times it can sound very formulaic or contrived, which yours doesn't. It seems very organic in that way. So kind of how did your group come together? Like how did the pieces that are a part of the group become Mama's Gun?
Yeah. Well, I'll just touch on what you were saying about it sounding authentic and organic there. I think we really, really, really focus on the songs being the thing because it's only the song that allows the production to be even better, to shine, you know. There's a lot of music out there that sounds good and it doesn't get replayed or you won't remember it. It doesn't have that because you haven't got the song. So, you know, that's the ethos around this band is just make sure the song is the thing and then build on it from there. But you can think of Mama's Gun as being two bands, everything from 2007 to 2015 and then 2015 to now. And from 2015 to now is very much where this band hit its stride. It found its home in terms of the personnel. From 2015-16, we made a record called Golden Days. And it's between that last record and this record that we released that 7-inch This Is A Day that you were talking about. And it really was the sound of us focusing the palette of sounds into this kind of deeper soul root, very much authentic in the way we record. I mean, look behind me, there's old instruments with dust all over them and tape machines over there. And it's a respect for the way people made records there because they help you imbue a certain atmosphere that you want in the recordings. So, yeah, 2015, new bass player, new drummer, which is arguably the engine of a band. And that's when we decided to really, you know, in mixes, turn up the bass more, you know, get some of that slinky rubber band bass happening and just really injecting more space in the productions. And that's just something the whole band seems to be able to get in on in a kind of synergy to bring this sound to these records. So yeah, it's me on vocals and I write most of the songs. It's Terry Lewis on guitar. It's Dave Oliver on keys, Chris Boot on drums and Cam Dawson on the bass. And hopefully it's just the sound of five dudes on the records that we make.
Yeah. And I think that's why I like the vintage sound. You had to practice, you had to hone your craft. You had to do, I mean, it has less bells and whistles than other types of modern music. And, you know, if your vibes are not right, literally and figuratively, as we see behind you, then it's problematic. And, you know, a lot of those records were made in very small spaces. You know, it was just about what the musicians were putting into it. So definitely having that bass and drums as the foundation, having the lineup of people that really get the vision of the group is super important. And obviously you guys have progressed in your sound, obviously from, you know, releasing your first records to now. So if you just generally take the audience through like a mini version of your catalog, your albums, like what gets us from the beginning origin and what you were thinking about to now Cure the Jones?
Yeah. So the first record, Roots to Riches, was out 2009. First albums are the sound of someone who's had their whole life to write those songs up until that point. So often it's kind of thought about too much, perhaps, the first record. But the first record has that thing, that youthfulness, that kind of first time, brand new thing that, you know, that makes a first record, a debut record. That very much touches on the soulful thing there, definitely. But it was recorded in quite hi-fi way, very modern, I guess it wanted to be a bit pop. Second album carried on from there, but that was the sound of me being more restless, wanting to be things all to all men, you know, explore different genres, different sounds, different textures and soundscapes. That was called The Life and Soul. The third album, Cheap Hotel, was probably the most extreme of that idea. The third one is a lot of fun, but it's very atomic. You know, it flits from highly energetic electro funk in the style of early 80s Prince or something like that to some really kind of moody kind of pop rock ballads. So as a whole collection, it can feel kind of disjointed. And perhaps it wasn't any surprise that that became also the end of first lineup. It wasn't till the last two albums, Golden Days in 2016, where suddenly it was just like this band of brothers that really kind of found something. And we decided to really focus the sound. So that was, we, like you said, we made it in one room. There was a tape machine, there was old stuff. It was about getting the songs down. One or two takes, no fussing, just get on with it. And then Cure the Jones is an extension of that, which we put out this year. And that's just, as I said, topics like isolation and everything that the pandemic brought with this sound that we'd found in 2016, but even deeper, even richer. So in a nutshell, there you go. Hope that was succinct enough.
No, for sure. And the good thing about the new album is it gives you new opportunities to get out and see the world and travel and tour. So you're going to be touring. Where are you headed? And like, where are you most excited to?
Well, we've been all over Europe this summer, which has been great. And the UK doing a bunch of festivals and headline shows. Literally just got back from France 2 days ago after some great shows out there and a wicked show at a place called New Morning in Paris, which is like a legendary venue. But hey, man, we are coming for you. We're coming for you guys. We're coming to the States, North America, I should properly say, really. I don't want to annoy the Canadians, obviously. 5th of October, New York. Baby's All Right. 7th of October, Toronto. 9th of October, Chicago. 12th of October, LA. And this is very much us, you know, coming over for the first time, sowing some seeds in the hope that we can come back next year and do even more shows, you know. So, this is the highlight in the calendar for us, this tour, something we've been working towards for a long time. And it just feels right now that this album has opened more doors than ever. And the time to kind of cross the pond and get over to America is now. So, yeah, we're super amped about this, man, big time.
Awesome, as you should be. I mean, just after the pandemic, being able to go anywhere is exciting. And then obviously Europe is your backyard, but if you can make it in America, you can make it anywhere. Plus, it's just, you know, the roots of the music and the style, and also they're lovers of and fans of that music here, and great venues that support it, and great radio stations that support it. So super excited about your tour, and glad you're going to come through our neighborhood in Los Angeles. We'll definitely promote it on the show. So now, when we come back, I guess, to the origins, we've learned a little bit about how the band came together, but how did you, the man, the myth, the musician, come together in terms of you're doing vocals, but obviously you have a bunch of instruments and here. So, like, how did you, I mean, from the parents' record collection, like, how did you actually get into music? Like, I have this gift, I have this talent, I want to share it with the world, and then kind of mature into that.
Yeah, I moved house, like, 20 times before I was 18. And that was down to my dad's work and being dragged across different places in the world. So I always had headphones on. And I guess that was a one consistent thread in my life, you know, changing schools, changing friends was all just came and went. And that kind of led me to being immersed in music all the time. So perhaps it wasn't a surprise. A stepping stone was kind of just playing stuff by ear. Piano in the house, learning how to play melodies off hearing from the radio. That led to piano lessons. So very quickly got into classical music. I did all the classical music grades. and then decided I wanted to play something way cooler. So guitars took over. And I was kind of writing songs from a very young age. I used to connect all my parents' old hi-fis together so that I could record stuff off the radio and then create my own radio shows. And then my in for songwriting was writing the jingles in between these radio shows I put together of music that I liked. So, I mean, if you listen to them now, they're just awful, but they're definitely the seeds of composition. So that's like 8 or 9 years old, started writing songs. From that, it was playing music in pubs in the UK. There's a healthy kind of music scene in pubs up in there. So 12, 13, I was in bands playing pubs. And then playing in clubs from 15, 16, writing songs and covers, you know, that's where I started to really get into kind of soul music and kind of early jazz leanings. And then I went to this place called Lipper in the UK, which is a music college that Paul McCartney started in Liverpool. Okay. It was his old school that him and John Lennon went to. And it was disused. And so he put 20 odd million of his money into it. Put a bunch of state-of-the-art studios, created this course, got some great lecturers, and I spent 3 years there from 97 to 2000, basically just playing and writing music every day with people from around the world. I got in as a songwriter, but I didn't write a song for 3 years. I was too interested in all the other stuff, kind of composition and technology and directing and... But you soon kind of, after you've learned that, you unlearn it. And it's weird. 6 months after leaving that with a degree, songs just started falling out of me. So I started writing again, moved to London and just bummed around that kind of circuit for a few years before I got that first publishing deal that I told you about. So, I mean, along the way, you know, countless bands, countless late nights, countless kind of emotional up and downs with creating music and not creating music, but that's the broad shape of kind of, you know, a child to an adult in my musical career.
And let's talk a little bit about the ups and downs. Now, I am a musician as well, so being a musician is hard. I mean, there's no other way around it, and it's not something that everybody gets into for the money or the fame. That won't keep you there, for sure. You have to be almost crazy to have longevity in it, because there's so many ups and downs, band implosions and changing personnel and changing labels and gigs that are great and fans are with you and then they're not with you and the fickleness of fans. And so, like, what kind of keeps you motivated and encouraged to keep going?
That's a really good question, and something I was actually talking to my wife about, and my bandmates, we touch on this now and then. There are many good reasons for what sustains you and what drives you in music. Some people, or some friends of mine, it's about leaving something behind. It's leaving a legacy, some kind of, you know, fingerprint that you leave behind. Which is a nice idea, but it doesn't really speak to me. I'm not here to kind of, you know, once I'm dead, for people to go, oh, well, look what he left for us. And, you know, it's a bit, maybe that's a bit self-interested. I love the live shows. I always think of them when they're great, that you're afforded this little glimpse into a world, however temporary, that 99% of the world don't get to see or feel. You know, when it's absolutely kicking off and it's people are just baying for blood and it's just the best feeling in the world. And you get these glimpses into this other world. It's magical. But that's not what keeps me going, I don't think. That's kind of a nice byproduct of making music. For me, it's just about getting better. I honestly just want to write the next best for 3.5, 4 minutes that I can. And whatever I'm doing in my life, touring or making records or whatever, it always comes back to the song. And my obsessiveness with writing songs and wanting to get better. You are only as good as your last song, I think, in many ways. But equally, you also need to consistently write not bad songs, but songs where that present avenues you know you're not going to go down again, because you need to kind of know where the red herrings are to kind of step over them and get to the good stuff, you know. So yeah, for me, it's really just about getting better and better and better. And I feel like I've been doing that since I was, you know, 21, definitely.
And that's true. I mean, if you're going to do anything that you love, you definitely want to continue to improve. I feel everyone can improve from birth to death. And I like what you were saying about leaving things behind. It's like, yeah, that's good. And it is so important. But more importantly, for people listening, is appreciated while this man is alive. Tell him that it's good. Show up, support, buy vinyl. You know, don't just stream, but feel free to stream and just, you know, be good individuals. Realize that what is coming through your terrible headphones and in the MP3 quality, which is not the best, somebody has put their life and blood and sweat and tears into that and deserves your respect. When you're at a show, unless you're, you know, filming or whatever, get off your phone, be mindful, pay attention, because someone is giving you something. And it's a transference of feelings. So when you're live, like, you're feeling something, you're tossing to them. When you toss that back or get that back from the audience, and like, it amps you up to give even more. So it's just like a better experience overall when we're having that collective shared experience. But I think for sure, we have gotten to a point with music where it's a little bit different than it was, I think. I mean, before my time, you know, 60s, 70s, I think people were like, oh, there's a band playing. Like, I'm amped. Because it wasn't like you could just clickety-click music whenever you wanted. So, like, people were used to having a sense of urgency, you know, when you wanted to see someone, like, they're going to be on TV. Like, I got to be there at 8 o'clock. Now everything is very passive. People are like, well, I'll listen to it when I listen to it, when I have some time. Or, you know, I don't need to go to the show because I could just pull it up on YouTube or whatever. So it's a little bit of a disconnect, I think, in the world with music. But what I like about the funk soul space is that people are audiophiles. People do like vinyl. People do like reading liner notes. People do like waiting for a band to sign their merch and to talk to them because they're very interested in the thing. It's just like certain labels at the time, you would look and be like, okay, that's a Motown artist. Like, I want to know everything about them. Who produced it, who wrote it, you know, what musicians were on it, that kind of thing. So I hope that culture comes back. I hope that even within digital platforms, we continue to find ways to push out this information. Like, you can see credits and a little bit of stuff, but I would love to see some type of digital liner notes in the future, if possible, so that you could kind of have a 3D experience, hologram, whatever it is, so that you're like, oh, that's cool. I would love to have this information if I had access to it. But
surely that's inevitable, man. You can only go so far into the ones and zeros of this digital world, and you're just going to create some kind of human side to it. You know, you're going to want the smoother corners and something to relate to. Because at the end of the day, it's you like all the things you're touching on. When human beings literally play music together, it's a magical thing, and everything that branches off from that are all the things that have meaning, you know. So I'm totally hearing what you're saying, and I'm there, big time.
Yeah, and you need to have that human connection for sure. Like, you look at all of these samples and things that people have taken and repurposed, and then you're like, yeah, like the funky drummer, that was a real guy. Like, someone was playing that. And that was coming from him. And obviously compensation, you know, some of those people never got paid for what they did. They got used so many times. And, you know, but when you copy a copy, then it degrades it. So that's why I'm always interested in people who, like, play instruments. Even if they only play, you know, amateur subpar, the point is that they're putting a kinetic energy. They're hitting something mechanical where a sound is coming out, which is a little bit different than electronic things, I feel like, are. When they're less organic, it compresses, and I mean, there's room for all those. We're gonna say I'm not hating them,
of course.
But you know, I'd rather hear a drummer on snare, hat, kick than a drum machine, if I had my choice. But I mean, but Prince did some amazing drum machines, so I'm not hating on it. I say use the technology, do what you have to do. So I guess now that we've gone on several tangents, what is next for you? Are you already thinking past this album? Because obviously I think albums have a gestation period. Mm. So you're usually, and you were talking about like, I want to get better and what's next. So is there anything next for Mama's Gun? And are you ever possibly going to do something solo on your own? Or is that not part of the lexicon of Andy?
That's always there. I have this to-do list, and on this little, there's a little section of the to-do list which just says like solo album, and then some of the tracks that I've kind of kept to the side that I thought might be good. One day, man, I don't know what it would sound like. I think it would have to be significantly different from what I do in Mama's Gun. I also have another band called Young Gun Silver Fox, which is very much the kind of yacht rock kind of thing. If you don't know, check it out. But it would have to be significantly different from those two groups, I think. But it definitely, I think, would be quite raw, perhaps acoustic. But I think just with the way I sing, the way I write stuff, it will probably be soulful automatically. Yeah. So I don't know, man. Watch this space. But as soon as this kind of album cycle starts to cool down, I'll probably get back into a writing zone again. I'm not very good at writing and touring at the same time. You know, all those dudes who like write these great songs in the hotel rooms. It's just not me. You know, I'm just desperately want to go to sleep or order a burger from room service. That's my hotel vibe.
Yeah, sometimes you sleep by the time the burger comes.
Yeah, totally.
So I guess just generally for people that are learning about Mama's Gun, like generally, what do you consider your sound to be? And I know that's hard because, you know, people are like, Miles Davis does jazz. He's like, I don't do jazz. So what do you think of your sound is?
I think maybe it might be a bit helpful where if you were to go where you could file this record in a record store.
Sure.
And I think it happily sits alongside, you know, I Want You Era, Marvin Gaye. That kind of vibe, Shuggy Otis. I think it would happily sit alongside stuff that's coming out of labels like Big Crown and Coal Mine and that kind of stuff too. So so in that sense, you know, it is this brand new secondhand thing, but it's, I think the songwriting is what makes it a contemporary thing. You know, it's not throwback stuff. I think that's a really lazy label for people who don't understand records to put on that. But I think, yeah, that's where it might sit in a record store section. Yeah,
well, that's a good place to be. I mean, the stuff that comes out from Big Crown and Coal Mine, always great, and they definitely get it. I mean, I love Color Red, Dab Tone, all the labels, Ubiquity, Tupac. So we have some rapid fire questions that we ask when we start to wrap up to all the artists. We want to talk about the next generation, and not just Star Trek, but in general. We want to talk about what would you tell a newbie starting out in music today? What advice would you give?
Just, as far as I'm concerned, just keep writing. It's the stuff at source that's going to matter. Yeah, you probably want to get better at playing, singing, making demos, getting good on Logic or whatever the kids are doing these days. But it's got to have something at the heart of it. So it's all about the songs. And there's one big thing I learned about songs. Is finish them. Don't let your hard drive fill up with unfinished symphonies, you know. Finish your ideas, put them to bed, move on, and that's how you improve. And you'll write great ones, you'll write terrible ones, but you'll only learn if you have a beginning, middle, and end to it.
Definitely great advice. And so we did talk a little bit about legacy, but when it's all said and done, even though you probably don't necessarily care what people are saying at the end, but if you could pick at the end, and I hope you go for many, many years and then eventually dump your ideas into a robot and it continues on after. What do you want people to remember you most for? The man, but also the music.
I definitely don't need that setup. I honestly, it just thought I was, he could write a song or two, maybe. That's, you know, he knew how to pen a song, perhaps. I don't know. Something like
that. And if you had to pick the one or two, your faves from your writing with the group or either group, what do you like, man? These, I knew these were the ones. Like, oh, I didn't know these were the ones, but these are the ones.
There's definitely one on the new album. There's a song called When You Stole the Sun from the Sky, which that was one of those classic lightning bolts that just fall in your lap, you know. I wrote that halfway through writing another song, which took 4 or 5 hours writing that one. But the one that landed in my lap took like 30 minutes, and then I got back to writing the other one. When You Stole the Sun from the Sky, I think is a good moment for me in my writing career. This whole self-analysis thing, I've never really liked it. I don't tend to read reviews either for the same reason. It's a bit, it's just a bit weird. Like I said, I think I know when I'm doing something that's good, and I don't, if I start making stuff or making what I think people want to hear from me, that's like game over, isn't it? That's deadly. So
I think the business side prefers that, but the artist side abhors it, because art is like, I need to get this out or I'll go crazy, and it has to be me. And if you water that down, the masses, then it becomes
so much about the industry is absolutely groomed and contrived and airbrushed to within a hair of its life, then at least just let the source be as unfettered as possible.
For sure. And so where can people find you online? Where should we point them to go?
So all the socials, all the regulars, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, we're there. We've got a main site, astonishingly. I didn't think bands had like websites these days. That seems so old, you know. Mamasgun.co.uk. You come and check out everything there, from releases to tour dates to whatever other stuff we might have on there. I have no idea.
but you know it's there. People can Google it. People can find you. People, obviously, streaming services can find you.
But we don't have a MySpace anymore.
Friendster. It's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
We're vintage, but not in terms of our digital technology.
Exactly, man.
Thank you so much, Andy Platt, everybody. 885 At Home Interviews, Deeper Groove. Super excited to be playing them. They're going to be coming across the pond to North America soon. And, you know, they're got a great album, Cure the Jones. It's out. People can listen to it. We're going to keep in touch with you, Andy. We're going to keep following your career. And we'll circle back when all the links are out so that we can promote it together. And I just love the music. Big fan. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Matt. And you're in LA, are you?
In Los Angeles, yep.
Well, I mean, happy to get you in on the guest for Moroccan Lounge show there if you're around.
Yeah, we'll make it happen.
Cool, man.
I would love to come.
Wicked.
All right. Take care. Have a good day.
Take care, man. This was fun. See ya. Yeah, later. Stay vintage.
You too.
Ladies and gentlemen, I really, really enjoyed talking with Andy Platt on Deeper Grooves. This is season 5, episode 49, going across the pond to the UK to talk to Andy Platt from Mama's Gun. They are getting some love for their new album, Cure the Jones. Garnered praise from Sunday Times, Billboard, The Guardian, and Uncut Magazine. The first three albums spawned top 10 hits on 4 continents, including the number 1 single in Japan, top 10 airplay in the UK and parts of Europe. And they also worked with the Vels Trio, who I love, and they appeared at the Billboard Music Awards and music festivals including Love Supreme, Java Jazz, and Soul Jazz Festival. Go check out their music on streaming platforms and come back next week for the last episode of season 5, and it's going to be a banger on Deeper Grooves with your host, Cliff Beach.